You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and glad to be with you on this beautiful day. Well, the Republicans, they had their own version. The Democrats had the progressive budget. The Republicans had the Republican Study Committee budget, which is even crazier than the Ryan budget. And the Democrats in the House of Representatives all voted present, which basically forced a Republican versus Republican vote on the thing. Because, the outcome would be the majority of who's left. And interesting times in the House of Representatives. But basically what we're seeing here is, the Tea Party ramping up. And John Boehner now starting to bow down to the Tea Party group again and saying, well, maybe we will shut down the government. The Tea Partiers didn't get their jollies last time, in fact, the last couple times. And so we'll see where that goes. Breaking news in the state of New Hampshire. I used to live in New Hampshire, the Live Free or Die state. Louise and I, when we lived there, we started the New England Salem Children's Village and the Hunter School, hunterschool.org, if you're looking for a good charity. It's a remarkable organization doing wonderful work. And a nonprofit. I think all schools should be not-for-profit. The board members are paid absolutely nothing. And the employees are frankly underpaid, but that's true, I think, of all schools. But in any case, the state of New Hampshire, including 10 Republicans, voted yesterday in their House of Representatives to the state of New Hampshire by 189-139. Now, that's a substantial majority, 189-139. In the House of Representatives in the state of New Hampshire, they voted to say corporations are not people, money is not speech. This is spreading. Now, specifically, the groups behind this were Public Citizen and Free Speech for People, but this is the work. I'm sure that Move to Amend had a nice hand in this. I'm reading the press release from John Bonifaz of Free Speech for People. These are all great groups. My personal favorite, of course, is movetoamend.org. And I would encourage you to get over to movetoamend.org and, congratulate them on their great work in New Hampshire. So, step by step. So let's talk about how, yesterday I said I want to make this program for a short while. I think that a class on economics, I think the most important thing that we can do here at Tom Hartman University, the most important thing that we can do is, if we want to prevent a crash or if we want to make it through the coming crash, is understand economics. It's really a circle, right? So when you say, okay, how do we define an economy? Well, there's really not a starting point, but there is a most important point. So let's start there. Demand. Demand is created by basically three things. Basic human needs. People need to eat, they need to sleep, they need a roof over their head. Needs. Desires. People want things. These are all things that you would say, oh, that makes perfect sense, that's demand. And paychecks. They have to have a way to fulfill that demand. And in terms of an economy, paychecks are, arguably one of the most important parts, because without a paycheck, without income, you can't get needs and desires met. So you got a paycheck, and you go out and you spend that. Well over 90% of Americans spend the vast majority, well over 95% of all the money that they make every single week. They spend it. Spend it at the store. They spend it at the movies. They spend it for rent. They spend it, at the grocery store, whatever. But so you go to the store and you buy something. Now, the store has to pay the clerk who helps you out and the stock boy who stocks the shelves or girl or whatever. And the people who run the machines, the checkout machines. And there's a billion things that go on. All those jobs are created because you bought something at that store. The store has to buy from their wholesalers. They have to buy from their manufacturers. The manufacturers have to get the raw materials to make their stuff. If it's like paper products, they have to go to a logger. If it's, car doors, the original source was a mine someplace. I mean, this is all along the way. It started out as dirt in the ground, and it has ended up as a car, as an automobile. Or it has ended up as the top of a jar of pasta or tomato sauce for pasta. Right? And every step along the way, for that thing that you bought in that supermarket, jobs were created to get it there so that you could buy it. And every one of those jobs put money into workers' pockets. So not only are you the job creator as the consumer, because you're starting the cycle by buying something, but you're contributing to the money that goes into the pockets of all these workers all along the way. And each one of them is going to take their paycheck and go to a store and buy something. And thus, demand spreads through the economy. And it all starts with you having a paycheck. Demand is the most important in this cycle of an economy. Now, obviously, you've got demand on the one side, you've got supply on the other. You have a paycheck and you have a need or desire. You go to the store and you say, I want something. Well, they've got to have it. They have to have supply. But demand is more important than supply, because without demand, those three pieces of demand, a paycheck, a need, and a desire, without all three of those, or at least two of the three of those, the paycheck and either the need or the desire, there's no economic activity. You can have supply all day long. You have completely full stores. You got people who have no money. They can't generate demand in an economy. Now, it is true that suppliers can stimulate demand. They can come out with a new kind of phone. They can come out with a new computer, for example. This is the stuff that's always thrown out by, you know, supply siders. Oh, you know, Apple, IBM. But it really proves the point, because if you got no paycheck, people can have desires all day long, but they don't have genuine what's referred to in economics as demand, because demand requires the ability to pay for something. I mean, arguably, you could say people will smash in windows and steal things. That's really not, in economic terms, that's not demand. And this is why the whole idea of supply-side economics is stupid. The real job creators, they're the people who buy things. So what happens when the job creators, the consumers, the people, you know, the people who buy things and thus create this virtuous cycle? What happens when they can't buy things because either they lose their wages or they lose their entire job? Demand collapses. There's no more things to buy in the store. You know, there's no more buying from the store. The store is not, you're not buying from the store. The store's not buying from the wholesaler. The wholesaler's not buying from the manufacturer. The manufacturer's not buying from the miner or the logger. And at each step along the way, all of those people pay employees. All of their employees are getting laid off. And all of those people now are no longer able to go to the store and buy things. So demand, right down the line, starts to collapse, and the economy spirals into a depression. And this was always the way it was in the United States from the founding of the Republic until the 1930s, which is why we never went more than 15 years without a stock market crash from 1787 to 1935. But then FDR, at the recommendation of John Maynard Keynes, put into place stabilizers to prevent these spirals that are inherent in capitalism. Since 1935, when people are unemployed, they can still buy things. And the reason they can still buy things is because they have unemployment insurance, food stamps, stuff like that. In other words, they still have the ability to buy. Additionally, government spending increases demand when capitalism fails by hiring people to do things like fix roads and bridges. These people now have paychecks, so they can resume their role as job creators, spending at the store. And when government spending is high enough, that downward spiral gets broken and the economy recovers. And then when the economy recovers, of course, the people who were getting government paychecks are now paying money into the government in taxes, and the deficit seems to go away. It doesn't seem to. It does go away. Pays down the government's debt. Econ 101. Pass it along.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the thing that is so astounding to me is how few conservatives, sir, obviously none who watch Fox News, get this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, I just want to go through very quickly the top 1%. This is the consequence of supply-side economics, the consequence of Reaganomics. The whole Reaganomics shtick was, oh, well, you know, Reagan quoted John Kennedy saying, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, it's a nice aphorism, but it assumes all boats are in the tide. Right? What if a bunch of the boats are on shore? They don't even have any water to be in. Well, you got 40 million Americans who are, you know, living on the absolute margins. The top 1% of Americans own 40% of everything that is privately ownable in this country. All American wealth. America is the richest nation on earth, and 1% of us own almost half of that, 40%. Meanwhile, the bottom 80% of us, the bottom four-fifths of us, you think, okay, four-fifths of all Americans, they must own at least half of the wealth of America, right? No. 40%? No. Well, hey, it's 80% of us. We must own 30% of the wealth? No. Well, to be in the bottom 80%, that means that, you know, at the top of bottom 80%, that's over $100,000 a year. That you've get, there's got to be, you know, 25%. They own a quarter of the wealth. No. 20%. Nope. 15%. Nope. 10%. No. 7%. The bottom 80% of all Americans own 7% of the wealth in this country. This is really simple stuff. The wealthiest 400 people in America now own more wealth than half of America, than 50% of America, 400 individuals, as a result of 32 years of Reaganomics. The wages of workers have not only not gone up since Reagan came into office, they've actually gone down. Household income has remained flat, but now households typically have one, you know, almost two workers in them, and in 1980 it was just a slightly over one. So individual wages have actually gone down. 120% of the gains since Bush came into office have gone to the top 1%, which means the bottom 99%, people making under $300,000 a year, all the way down to making $5,000 a year, they've actually gone backwards. And here's the shocker. Since the Bush crash of 2007, the median wealth for middle-class families has dropped 40%. Now, admittedly, most of this was in housing, but a fair amount of it was in the stock market and 401ks and IRAs and what, and now with loss of income, people having to convert their savings and all this. A loss of 40% is the equivalent of 18 years of savings for the middle class has been wiped out by the bad behavior of the banksters, thanks to Republican Phil Graham and 32 years of Reaganomics. Meanwhile, corporations are just in fat city. Corporate profits are at a higher point than they've been in 60 years, and the amount of taxes that are actually paid by corporations is lower than it's been in 40 years. Forget about the top tax rate. We got a top tax rate of 35%. Nobody pays that. 26 major corporations, you know, 26 of the 100 most profitable corporations in America last year paid absolutely nothing in their taxes. Many of them got money back. And in some cases, it was banks who got money back because they got hit with fines for being criminals, and they were able to write off as a cost of doing business, paying those fines to the government. And you still got screwed. I mean, just consider how bizarre this is. This is Reaganomics. I don't believe it. It says here that Joe disagrees with me. Joe in Vienna, Virginia. Really?
Yeah, it's because you're mischaracterizing, you're setting up straw men, basically. And, you know, you do understand some economics, but you understand basically socialist economics. I also have an economics degree from Ivy League University. And it is.
So did Milton Friedman, and he devastated Argentina.
It makes it sound like all you have to do is take money from one group of people, give it to another group of people, and everything will be solved. That is not at all the answer. It has never worked in a society. It didn't work in the Soviet Union. It didn't work in China. It didn't work in Cuba.
Joe, speaking of straw men, you're creating the ultimate straw man here by accusing me of being a communist. That's absolute and utter nonsense. Now, the fact of the matter is that I am saying that government should borrow money and spend it to fill in the holes of the business cycle, which are inevitable with capitalism.
And how and well it is that worked in Greece and Europe?
It has worked very well. What's going on in Europe right now, the problem with Europe has to do with the European Union and that artificial 3% budget deficit limit that causes countries, when countries go into recession, Europe is in recession right now, as is most of the world, thanks to the bad behavior of our banksters and Republicans like Phil Graham. Europe is in recession, and when countries in Europe go into recession, they have automatic stabilizers in place. Joe, if you know anything about economics, you know this. There are automatic stabilizers in place in the European countries. That the primary automatic stabilizer is unemployment compensation. So when somebody goes from being employed to being unemployed, now instead of paying taxes into the government, they're taking money out of the government. The government starts running a deficit. To be a member of the European Union and use the euro as your currency, your budget deficit cannot run more than 3% of GDP annually. And when the countries, these countries of, which was stupid, when these countries of Europe went into recession, they started running deficits in excess of 3%. And so they had to borrow money in order to get that deficit down. They're borrowing money from the wealthy countries, the Germans and the banksters, independent banksters. And those people are saying now, you know, actually, we don't want to loan the money to you anymore. We want you to sell the Acropolis. We want you to stop giving your people health insurance. We need you to stop paying unemployment benefits because we're going to stick with that 3% threshold. It is crazy. And it has nothing to do with the United States. The way that the United States is structured has not, you know, we don't have a 3% arbitrary limit. Now, I know the Republicans would like us to have one, Joe. They would love it if we were to say, oh, yeah, we got this debt ceiling limit, and, hey, it's coming up. Let's run up against it and shut everything down. But we don't have to. We don't have to behave stupid the way the Greeks are being forced to by essentially the Germans, because we can print our own money.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We are a sovereign nation. We control our own destiny. God save us from the crazy right-wing economists. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I've been caught off on my whole financial thing. And how did this Reaganomics happen? How did our economy get destroyed by the banksters and the wealthy plunderers and the kleptocrats and now the oligarchs? Well, by buying off Congress. And that goes back to 1973 when Richard Nixon put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court, and then Lewis Powell participated in the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, and in the early 80s and in the later 80s, the First National Bank versus Bilotti decision, the first one saying money is speech, the second one saying corporations have rights under the Constitution, and then those two got magically merged and put on steroids in Citizens United in 2010. So, my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, which one of our callers today is going to get a free copy of, courtesy of stamps.com. That book, Rebooting the American Dream, Chapter 6, came out 2 years ago. Still, this is the book that Bernie Sanders signed a letter to all the other 99 senators. We hand-delivered one to every single senator in the United States, and he read from it in his filibuster on the floor of the Senate. Chapter number 6 in Rebooting the American Dream, and you can read it, actually, the entire book for free online over at truthout.org, or, you know, you can always buy one, but I'm not trying to plug the book. I was here's what it is. I just wanted some, you know, I think this is a brilliant idea. I'm not sure that it originated with me. It probably originated with one of my callers. I don't remember where it originated, but 2 years ago I wrote it. 3 years ago I wrote it. 2 years ago it was published. It's called, the chapter of the title was Make Congressmen Wear NASCAR Patches, or Make Members of Congress Wear NASCAR Patches, gender neutral. Now there is a logo, or now there is a petition, a White House petition, to make lawmakers wear logos of their financial backers on their clothing like NASCAR. And they say that the size of the patch should match the donation. Now, they got a little more detailed than I did in Chapter 6 of Rebooting the American Dream. They said the size of the logo or name would vary with the size of the donation. For example, a $1 million contribution could warrant a patch of about 4 by 8 inches on the chest, while a free meal from a lobbyist would be represented by a quarter-sized button. Individual donations under $1,000 exempt. I think this would be so cool to see members of Congress standing up there dressed like NASCAR drivers. I mean, let's know. there really should be something to the legislation, by the way, that allows the penetration of front groups. So, you know, if Koch Industries or General Electric or Verizon or whatever it may be, if they're giving money to the FreedomWorks or, you know, Americans for Smiling Puppies, and then Americans for Smiling Puppies gives money for Americans Who Like to Bounce Cats, and then Americans Who Like to Bounce Cats gives $100,000 to the member of Congress, that we can penetrate those front groups and say, oh, yeah, this came from Koch Industries, so that they have the right patch on, right? Because otherwise all the members of Congress would end up with, you know, patches. You and I both know this. If they had to wear NASCAR patches that came from the group that actually gave them finally handed them the money, it would be Americans for Puppies, Americans for Smiling Kittens, Americans for Happy Children, Americans for Apple Pie, Americans Who Think Cherry Pie is Better Than Apple Pie. I mean, you know, whatever. That's how it would be. Ken, in Great Falls, Montana, you have some thoughts on this economic issue. You want to share them with us? Have to do with the game of Monopoly?
Thanks for taking my call. You know, when I ever get in an argument with an idiot libertarian, I always tell them, you know, they always talk that the reason things don't work is they don't have the perfect situation. Well, the perfect situation is the game of Monopoly.
Right.
Everyone starts out at the same level, and then you have the capitalist system, and you go. But what happens every time, hour and a half, three of you are sitting over drinking cocoa in front of the party, in front of the fire, then two people go another 15 minutes, then the game's over. One guy has everything.
Right.
It happens every time you play.
Right. That's the way it's designed. And, in fact, Alice, I don't think her last name was Walker, although that's my recollection. Maybe it was Miller. In any case, her name was Alice. The woman who designed Monopoly, maybe it was Mary, whatever. There was a woman who designed the Monopoly game back in the 1920s, and she explicitly said that she was designing this game to explain to people. She was a Georgist, a follower of Henry George, the famous late 19th century, early 20th century economist. And to explain to people how capitalism, the whole rentier system, basically, rentiers in Anglo-speak, how that system always ended up in monopoly absent government constraints. And you're absolutely right. It is the very best way to debate with libertarians. Elizabeth Maggie Phillips was the woman who came up with monopoly. Thank you, Shano, for that.
Wow.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Brilliant suggestion. Dewan in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Dewan, what's up?
Devon.
I'm sorry.
Well, seeing this economics 101 lesson, you left out something that Joe probably knows pretty well. Joe's probably living in one of the wealthiest zip codes in the U.S. They're around Washington, D.C., I understand. Vienna is anyway.
Yeah, they are. Now, it is now, actually, the zip codes that surround this city are now, you know, they beat out Beverly Hills. They are the wealthiest zip codes in the United States.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the war and all the bonds.
You think?
I wonder if, like, defense, yeah.
Gee.
So, Joe, here's how it goes. There's this thing called confidence, consumer confidence, and that's, you know, something you can't actually measure, but it plays a huge role. And my understanding is that that's why in Germany they cut people back to three-quarter time rather than firing people, because then, hey, at least you've still got a job. You're making less, but it creates, you know, some confidence and well-being and security.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we, you know, throw people off. We don't need you anymore. Job over. And that becomes a self-fulfilling spiral.
Exactly. Perhaps. Exactly. Very well said. The program in Germany is called Kurzarbeit. Kurz is, K-U-R-T-Z, is the German word for short. And Arbeit is the word for work. In fact, famously over the, I think it was the Dachau concentration camp, it said, Arbeit macht frei, work makes you free. Ha ha. Bad joke. But, I mean, it wasn't intended as a joke, I suppose, but whatever. Kurzarbeit, it means short work. And what it was that the government said to the employers, have your employees work instead of a 40-hour week, have them work a 30-hour week or whatever it was. I don't recall the exact percentage that the decrease was. Have them work a 30-hour week because you really only need 30 hours worth of productivity out of these people right now. And we don't want supplies to build up in excess because that'll destabilize prices. So have your employers only work a 30-hour week, but pay them 90% of their paycheck, and we will pay you, the employer, the spread between, say, they're working a 70% week and the 90% that we want you to pay them. And so the government paid this out of the Kurzarbeit Fund, which came out of taxpayer dollars, and that's why Germany never went into serious recession when the rest of the world did. And you're absolutely right. And what it did was, you know, as I said, demand is made up of three things, arguably, or two things, and one has two subdivisions. One is cash, the ability to buy things, a paycheck, and the other is either needs or desires, and or both. And people's needs and desires don't go away, but their ability to have cash does. And to a certain extent, needs or desires can be moderated by consumer confidence. That's a measure of whether people are going to exercise their desires as opposed to their needs, and you know, how they're going to spend their money, whether they're going to save, whether they're going to deleverage or not, which is another big problem, because a lot of people, if they have low consumer confidence, they make extra money. Instead of spending that, in other words, instead of creating more demand, in other words, instead of being a job creator, what they do is they pay down their debt. And that doesn't help the economy in terms of, you know, pulling us out of a spiral either. So you have it, Devon. Thank you very much. A brilliant analysis, and thanks for bringing that up. David in Mukilteo, Washington. Hey, David. David?
Yeah.
It says here you disagree with me on the cause of income disparity. What does that mean?
Yeah, I want to, the simplest way to explain it, what's causing the increase in income disparity.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe you can give me a logical reason where I'm wrong, is an entrepreneur will risk his capital to hire an individual to produce a product, and he sells it at a price. Out of that price, he has to realize a return on investment. Profit margin. He has to pay for his capital structure.
Oh, hang on just a second. I think you're starting in the wrong place. Speaking as somebody who's been an entrepreneur for 40 years. Seriously, just consider this for a moment. As an entrepreneur, I have never hired somebody to make something in the hope, and put my capital at risk in the hope that someone will buy it. I have always looked at actual needs in the marketplace, demand, and said, I'm going to fulfill that demand.
Demand is always there. Demand is not scarce.
No, not true.
You guys don't get that concept.
Not true.
Of course.
Not true.
What don't you demand?
If I decide that I'm going to make a factory to make pet rocks, there is no demand for pet rocks right now. Why would I put my capital at risk?
There's always demand for something, though. There's always demand. Demand is unlimited.
That's the key to being a successful entrepreneur, is figuring out what the demand is out there for. And that's why I say you're missing the first
equation. If you'd let me finish.
Okay. Go for it. We have a minute.
You've done your research, you're going to produce a product, you have to hire a person, you sell it at a price. You realize your profit, you pay for your capital structure, and the balance is split of that price between the burden of government and the wage. Bigger the burden of government, lower the wage.
Yeah, it's a nice formula, David, but in the real world, it doesn't actually exist, because if you don't make a profit, there is no burden of government. David, thank you for your call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you do make a profit, then the burden of government was relatively small because, gee, you made a profit. 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tavis Smiley on the line with us, the host of the Tavis Smiley Show and Smiley and West with Dr. Cornell West, author of 16 books, his latest, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto, and the work he's doing right now, looking at the Latino community and what's going on with immigration and this whole debate around immigration, the website thelatinonation.com. Tavis Smiley, welcome back to the program.
Tom, always an honor to be on with you. How are you, my friend?
Just great. I hope you are well.
I'm doing the best I can.
Good. So tell me about this new work that you're doing, or this new investigation, or how would you characterize it, first of all?
Yeah, it's just our continuing effort to try to make sure that the suffering of fellow citizens is rendered visible, as opposed to invisible, and certainly the Latino community growing in leaps and bounds in terms of political clout and political participation, that community's concerns ought to be taken seriously. When you get down to it, beyond the issue of immigration, which is, again, an issue that impacts all Americans, okay, their concerns are the same as ours, and so I don't feel like I'm doing anything extra special. It's just that I've always, used my platforms on public television and public radio to try to raise questions that challenge us to reexamine our assumptions and expand our inventory of ideas and to see the world through a different prism. And I was really struck, as I suspect you were, by the fact that there will be no ban on assault weapons that's going to reach the Senate floor for a vote. And I'm still, you know, I'm not naive, and neither are you. We know how this process works, but I'm still kind of spinning, Tom, after all the talk. Reminds me of my grandmother used to always say that when all has been said and done, more often stuff is said and not done. And so we're now not even going to have a vote. I can't imagine. I mean, put yourself back where you were. Go back to a few weeks ago after Sandy Hook, and just imagine now that the Democrats have decided, Harry Reid and others, that we're not even going to have a vote on this on the floor because we don't think we can get it through.
Yeah.
So as a result, you know, I don't know what happens next. And we're not even sure that I'm not even sure they're going to get through the centerpiece of the Obama legislation, which is, you know, background checks and the like. I say all that to say, back to your question about Latinos, that some things that we perceive are foregone conclusions don't quite work out that way.
Yeah.
So we're not going to have an assault weapons ban this year. And now you talk about immigration reform. Is that really going to happen? Or might we look up in a few months in the Hispanic and Latino community and realize that that ain't going to happen either? The point is, it's time to have a conversation, not just about that issue, but all the issues that matter in their community as they're growing across the country by leaps and bounds.
Oh, I agree. You have a gig coming up in Chicago, don't you? Is it called Latino Nation Beyond the Numbers?
Saturday, April the 6th, and for those who are in the Chicago area, Saturday, April the 6th will be live at Chicago State University in the Jones Convocation Center for these symposia that I've, you know, become known for doing. Mm-hmm. There are two panels that day, one in the morning at 8:30, the other in the afternoon at about 1:30. So two panels. I think C-SPAN is taking it live all day. The following week on my TV show on PBS, we'll be broadcasting over three nights this conversation, so you can catch live. In Chicago, at Chicago State, if you're there, or on C-SPAN, I think, the next week. Again, three nights on my PBS program. But we're coming there to have this conversation with a broad swath of leaders in the Latino community, in business and in labor, in government and in private industry, in the foundation and philanthropic community, to political activists. So a little bit of everybody's going to be involved in this conversation, the influencers and thought leaders, to really talk about where their community is, where this community is headed, how they maximize this particular moment, and why all of this matters to those of us who happen not to be Latino.
Yeah, and speaking of those of us who happen not to be Latino, I'm assuming that's you, and that's definitely me. and although I have Latino members of my family, and you may, I don't know, but
sure.
But the point is that a couple of years ago, this was actually a big deal meme being pushed by the right wingers, the Republicans in particular, that there was conflict between the African American community and the Latino community. Now, I haven't heard so much about that lately. I'm guessing that meme didn't fly so well.
Right.
But what is was there anything to that, or was this just, you know, trying to gin up some trouble? And what's going on?
There are always those who obviously wanted to divide and conquer on the one hand. On the other hand, the conflict and the tension between Black and Brown America is real. I know it's real because I sit right now in my hometown of Los Angeles in our school system. You know, a couple of years ago, it was like every other day, these Hispanic kids and Black kids were getting to it at school. Now, more often than not, they go to school and they get along and they're friends, etc. But there was something happening, something in the water a couple of years ago here in L.A. that these kids were drinking that had them at each other's throats, you know, almost every day in school. So in the neighborhood that I sit right now in South Central Los Angeles, you know, this area used to be exclusively African American. And as African Americans have left the area, Hispanics are coming into the area. And so you do in places like Chicago and in places like L.A. and beyond. You see, you know, there are moments and pockets of Black and Brown tension, and I suspect that's going to be a part of our conversation as well. So we'll talk about the Black and Brown tension. We'll talk about the notion of assimilation and whether or not too many Latinos want to assimilate into the broader, make that white culture. We'll talk about education. We'll talk about foreign policy. We'll talk about all the issues. I think part of the problem is, and I feel sorry for my Latino friends in the sense that the things that matter to them, the broad, all the stuff on their docket, put it this way, Tom, the stuff on their docket can't ever really get addressed, because the minute you say Latino or Hispanic, you think immigration.
Right.
And all these other things that matter to them, they never get a national platform to talk about those things. So again, I don't think I'm doing anybody any favors. It's the kind of stuff that I believe in doing, giving people a voice. But if I were a Latino leader, I'd be tired of, you know, being boxed into a conversation exclusively about immigration.
Well, yeah, and we've seen that movie before. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King talked a lot about jobs, about social justice, about poverty, about the rights of workers, but the rights of white workers.
That's right.
And all of that stuff got just washed off by just the, you know, the segregation, integration, civil rights.
Equally as important, as you recall, and this is what part of what cost him his life, the minute that King moved out of that box, so to speak, of talking about racial politics,
right,
and wanted to come out and did come out aggressively against the war in Vietnam,
yeah,
they told Martin, sit your black behind down and shut up. This is not your lane. You don't talk about U.S. foreign policy. You talk about race politics. That's the box we let you operate in. But once he moved out of that box, they came after Dr. King.
Yeah,
right. And so the same thing, you know, is happening to some Latino leaders now. I mean, they want to raise other questions. They don't really get the kind of audience and attention that they deserve.
Yeah. Tavis Smiley, I you know, this is we are just scratching the surface, and people can check out you really digging deep into this, thelatinonation.com, and coming up again, it's April 6th, you said, Saturday?
Saturday, you got it.
Okay, great. Thanks
you,
a lot for being with us, Tavis.
Hi, my friend.
Good talking with you. Good talking with you, my friend. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew Smith is on the line with us. He is the COO of Yunkin Majestic Paint Corporation and the author of Sand in the Gears, How Public Policy Has Crippled American Manufacturing. And I'm assuming that book is available, sir?
Yes. Hi, Tom. It's available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble and wherever books are sold.
Okay. Sand in the Gears is the title. So if I get it, and I've read a piece of the book here, your thesis is that regulations are crippling American manufacturing. Why is it that if that's the case, why is it that American manufacturing started going offshore when we dropped tariffs, not when we started regulating? I mean, we've been regulating, rather aggressively regulating manufacturing since the 19-teens, but it wasn't until we dropped the tariffs that manufacturing started going offshore.
Right. So my book is about six areas of public policy: the tax system, healthcare, the legal system, workers' compensation, labor policy, and government regulations. So government regulations are a piece of what I think has been driving the decimation in manufacturing jobs. So it's not the whole story. The conventional wisdom is that offshoring occurred to chase cheaper labor and globalization of markets. But I'm telling the rest of the story, which is that we did this to ourselves. These six areas of public policy have created a hostile environment for manufacturers.
And yet in every single one of those areas, Germany regulates their companies more aggressively. Their German corporations pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes, and Germany collects a higher percentage of GDP from corporations as taxes than we do. We're at a 60-year low right now, regardless of what the top marginal tax rate is.
Yeah,
labor has German corporations. If you have more than 1,000 employees, you must have 50% of your board made up of representatives organized labor. I mean, the countries that are doing the very best in manufacturing around the world, China's a lousy example because of state capitalism, although you will find much of the same thing there. And they're starting to, you know, more aggressively regulate their companies, seem to dispute your charge.
Sure. Well, you know, Germany is a terrific example of a great manufacturing country. They have a very different system than we do. They have a different education system. They have a different way that they work together researching. And they also have a cultural difference. Something called Technik is really built into the German culture, the way they care about precision. So this isn't a comparative study of different countries. It's really a focus on the United States. And, you know, I tell the story of how we own the world after World War II. The rest of the industrial world was destroyed And we had about 30 to 35 years to ourselves where we dominated the manufacturing markets.
Not so much. I mean, if you look at our international trade figures, our exports went up about 2% at their maximum around 1948. We did not, you know, export trade, we showed a trade surplus throughout the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s.
Yeah, that's right.
70s, but it was not a significant part of GDP. Almost all of our manufacturing was for our domestic markets.
Right. Well, you know, we've had...
It's a handy myth to say, oh, yeah, you know, we devastated Europe's, ability to manufacture goods for their own people. But actually, the Marshall Act, we didn't do foreign aid the way the Japanese do. We didn't say, here's some money, buy products from us. We actually built... You know, we gave the Germans money to build their own cement and steel factories to make their own stuff.
Sure. Well, that may have been a better way to do it, but, you know, they're great trading partners. And again, when you look at the jobs picture, manufacturing jobs in the U.S. peaked at about 21 million when I graduated high school in 1980. Today, there are about 12 million jobs in manufacturing. And if we had grown manufacturing employment at the same rate as the economy, we'd have about 30 million jobs. So we've got to look at the big picture here, and the book really focuses on the policies that we have in the United States that we can control. Look, there are going to be foreign competitors. There are going to be foreign markets. We're not going to have the world to ourselves anymore, but we're still a big power. We're practically tied with China for the largest manufacturing economy in the world. So we have a lot to offer the world.
But manufacturing has gone from being 25% of our GDP to 11% of our GDP, whereas FIRE, the finance, insurance, and I forget what R&E stand for, but there are variations on that, reinsurance or something.
Sure.
That economy, the FIRE economy, has replaced it. It was under 10%. It's now over 20% of our economy. It's the financialization of our economy. And it certainly looks to me like you can track that back to two pretty simple things, changes in our trade policies that really began with Nixon, and the whole most favored nation status stuff that he wanted to do with China to open it to Pepsi-Cola, and then Reagan stepping that up, and then Bill Clinton putting it on steroids with NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, and Reagan dropping the top tax rate on individuals from 74% down to 28%, and stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Act. So you had, you know, giant monopolies, including transnational monopolies, eating our small and medium-sized businesses. And Reagan's basically starting the aggressive dialing back of corporate income taxes to the point where, you know, during the Eisenhower administration, corporate income taxes accounted for over a third of total government revenues, and now it's just slightly more than 10% of total government revenues.
Sure. Well, you know, I'll mention briefly the trade policy. I don't think most people who study economics really favor imposing more trade barriers. Obviously, we want a fair playing field, but I don't think the data will really show that there's a correlation between success in manufacturing and having trade barriers. In fact,
then why did the Japanese, the Germans, the Chinese, the Taiwanese, and the South Koreans all have aggressive trade barriers?
Sure. Well, one of the things about U.S. manufacturers is that we import a very large amount of what we put into our production. So it would actually hurt U.S. manufacturers if we impose greater trade barriers.
Well, the vast majority of that is in two categories. It's oil, and that's probably 80 or 90% of everything that goes into what we're manufacturing. And our oil imports are going down steadily. And the other is rare earth metals, and that's because we closed the last rare earth metals mine in California because China was undercutting the market. Now we're reopening that mine. We're going back into manufacturing our own rare earth metals. We're starting aggressive recycling programs. So I don't see where that would be a harm to us. And Germany, I mean, you know, most of these countries are using VAT taxes to have the equivalent of a tariff.
And you know, that's a great segue into my proposal for the tax system. So you mentioned corporate tax rates, but one of the things my book focuses on is something different because everybody talks about corporate tax rates. I talk about the sales tax system, and that hurts manufacturers in two ways. So first of all, we're taxing manufactured products, and in most places we're not taxing services at all. So I recommend that we stop doing that and we have a broad base that will tax everything at a relatively lower rate. And secondly, I do propose that we have a value-added tax, a progressive value-added tax, in fact, and that will help manufacturers as well because currently manufacturers are being taxed twice. They're being taxed on the products when they're sold, and they're also being taxed when they purchase products because we don't have a value-added system at the state level.
Right, and I don't disagree with that. And the way that the Germans and the Chinese and the Chinese have been doing this, they've turned this into an art form. you know, the average VAT tax in Germany is around 15%. When you aggregate the, at least in the automotive industry, you aggregate all the, you know, at every level of production, there's a small tax added as value is increased. For this, from the steel to the, from the iron ore to the steel, from the steel to the door to the car, from the door to the car to the car. And then when they export that car to somebody other than a German, they say, oh, we'll reverse out that 15%. So that's a 15% discount for exports. And then on the other hand, if you want to take an American car and import it into Germany, they say, hey, you want to import that car here? You haven't paid a VAT tax, so we're going to charge you a 15% tax when it hits our border. That's a 30% spread, which is about, from literally, from Alexander Hamilton putting into place in the second, third year of the Washington administration, 30% tariffs on imported goods. That 30% was roughly the average tariff rate that we had up until the early 1980s.
Right. Well, you know, this is a pro-manufacturing book, and I'm not sure that it would be considered progressive, but there are things in sand in the gears that progressives will love.
Yeah. It's an interesting, it's very interesting. Andrew Smith, his book Sand in the Gears, bashing government regulation but promoting a VAT tax. Maybe we can meet in the middle here. Andrew, thanks for dropping by.
My pleasure.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we bring manufacturing back to the United States? I think it's pretty straightforward. Talk Media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back, Doug, in St. Peter's, Missouri. Hey, Doug. You wanted to talk about
Tom.
How this was the expose that Matt Taibbi did that was so brilliant in Rolling Stone about how Greece got into this mess in the first place?
Correct. And I was brought up to that point by the Joe, who just elitist contempt was dripping from his lips. Reminded me of Dick Cheney. But it was
the earlier caller who accused me of being a communist, basically, you mean?
Yeah. It's amazing to me. He overpaid for his education. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
Matt Taibbi, and I read that article in the Rolling Stone, and he laid out how they fudged the numbers to
they
make
being Goldman Sachs.
Like Goldman Sachs were the ones who brought them in and fudged the numbers and created the situation so they could get into the euro.
Oh, they being Greece.
When the crash happened.
Yeah.
Right, Greece. And you've gone on about Spain as well, because you mentioned that in there, and Spain was doing okay until all this happened.
Yep.
Their rate debt to GDP was within means, and I think it's more of a case where the banks do not do anything without making a profit. So when you had Dave on there, and he was talking about the fact that they risked their money. There was an interesting article that was done in the New Yorker, and this was 2 or 3 years ago by one of the writers. I can dig it up for you. And she talks about how Ted Turner made his money. He didn't risk anything. He had bonds passed. He got bonds put in before he took a step. So he had other people assuming the risk.
Right.
While he was making the money off of it.
Yeah, I almost went off on that at that point because most entrepreneurs actually finance their businesses with debt or investment. They don't put their own money
exactly.
at risk. And
exactly.
Only the very smallest of entrepreneurs put their own money at risk. And they're not, you know, they're not the ones who are driving the economy. And even the very small ones. I mean, you know, one of the most successful businesses that Louise and I started, International Wholesale Travel, Sprayberry Travel in Atlanta, we built it up over over a 3 year period. It became a $6 million business and we sold it off in 86. We started in 83. We started that business with a $15,000 line of credit on my American Express card. You know, it's like,
that's pretty good.
I started the business with debt, right? But no, literally we started with a business with debt. And that's how I think most people do. Our very first business that actually grew reasonably well was, you know, an herb company, an herbal tea company back in the 70s. And we started that with, just working out of our bedroom, just very, you know, bootstrapping it with the money from my unemployment checks. I mean, you know, we were living on unemployment. We were just bootstrapping this thing. I was going around knocking on the doors of health food stores saying, will you put up a rack of our herbal teas? And they were like, sure, and see how it sells. And it just grew, you know. So, and then Celestial Seasonings came along and ate our lunch. So you win some, you lose some, and you learn lessons in between. But we had a couple of good years there. But the point is that you're absolutely right. A, Greece would not be in the situation they are in if Goldman Sachs hadn't lied them into, hadn't helped them hide their debt so that they could qualify for the under 3% debt to GDP ratio necessary to be in the European Union. They never should have joined the EU in the first place. Goldman Sachs, by the way, number two, got their money. They made a huge payment. They made a fortune on that deal. Plus, they're making sure that they're getting paid even now. If my understanding or recollection of Matt Taibbi's column is correct, and in fact he came on this program to talk about it, and perhaps number three, entrepreneurs typically don't put their own capital at risk. Businesses don't put their own capital at risk. They put other people's money at risk, investors' money at risk. But all of that said, I think probably the number four, the most important point here with regard to Greece and all this other stuff, is that when the EU was conceived, there was this idea, the European Union, with everybody using the euro, even though they are independent nation states that had their own sovereign currencies, they all decided to give up their sovereign currency, or most of them. England didn't, so they didn't fully integrate with the EU. And the same with all of the Scandinavian countries. But the point is that they tried to build into these agreements something that would protect the banksters. The banksters, you know, the big banks own the European Central Bank, and that would protect the banksters and the European Central Bank. And that mechanism that they put into place that they thought would protect the banks is that no country could ever have an annual budget deficit of greater than 3%, because you run a 3% budget deficit for, you know, a decade or so, and pretty soon you're deeply in debt, and you may have a country that would be facing bankruptcy, and that would be a risk. You know, bankruptcy is a risk to banks. That's the essence of the word. Bankruptcy. And so this 3% limit was put on. And the problem is that any rational economist, and there were plenty of economists and people like me who are lay economists screaming about this at the time, were saying, if you put an arbitrary 3% debt limit per year on countries going into debt, what you're doing is blowing up the ability of a country to have a mechanism to counter-cyclical mechanism to balance out the absolutely predictable cycles of capitalism, of boom and bust. Capitalism has this thing called the business cycle, where you're up one year, you're down the next. And in the years that you're up, governments get more taxes and their debts go down. In fact, sometimes they show surpluses. And when you're down in the down part of the business cycle, government spending has to go up if you're going to have those stabilizers in there to maintain demand, back to the first, you know, our Econ 101, the first hour of this program, and that primary stabilizer being unemployment insurance. And when governments have to start paying that stuff out to their people, they have to go in debt to do that. And that's what's happened to Spain and to Greece and to Portugal and Ireland and to Italy. It's not that they've been profligate spenders. It's not that their social welfare states don't work. It's that the 3% debt limit that the EU is trying to enforce, you know, the recession is hitting them with 4, 5, 6% unemployment. That's taking, you know, 3, 4, 5% out of their economy. When your economy drops 4%, you got to fill that in, and 5%, you got to fill that in with government spending. Suddenly your debt is over 3%. And the EU is saying you can't have that. So you've got to stop spending money for unemployment benefits or for health care benefits. And it's ripping apart these European countries. And there's no good reason for it. It was there originally to so-called protect the banks. And it doesn't work. It was stupid. It should be abandoned. Doug, thank you for the call. Excellent point. And you know, I predict, you know, I talked about this yesterday. Either the 3% limit is going to be done away with, or it's going to be ignored, or the EU is going to dissolve, or you're going to see war in Europe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the situation in Cyprus right now is showing how fragile it all is, number one. And number two, how greedy the banksters are. Let's just take it from the people. So, how do economies work? It's pretty simple stuff. People buy things. People want things. But you say, well, what role does money play in this? Well, money is just the medium of exchange. It's just, you know, it doesn't have intrinsic value in and of itself. Yes, there have been times when we've used coins that did have intrinsic value, gold and silver, but those coins were never issued by any society, whether it was the Romans or whether it was the early Americans. At to represent, I mean, you know, the value of the gold in the coin or the silver. I mean, you'd have a $10 coin that had 15 cents worth of gold or silver in it or whatever it was. I mean, it was never one to one. There was always intrinsic, there was the extrinsic value, the societal value always exceeded the intrinsic value. The main reason to use precious metals wasn't because they were precious metals. It was because they didn't corrode easily, and it made it more expensive to counterfeit. But principally because they didn't corrode easily. But in any case, I see Robert disagrees with me that consumers don't create demand. This should be an interesting conversation. Robert in Stony Point, New York, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How you doing, Tom?
I'm well, thank you.
Well,
where am I wrong?
I just want to bring out the iPhone. Steve Jobs said that you can have people in focus groups and find out what they want, and then when you finally do come out with what they want something else. And my daughter's a classic example. When the iPhone first came out, I had given her a cheap flip phone, and that's what I was going to give her. That was the basics. She went out, got herself two babysitting jobs, and she worked at our local Carvel just so she can save up and buy herself an iPhone. And this created
demand.
This was created by Steve Jobs. It wasn't created by her wanting it, because had she not known that it was out there, she wouldn't have gone out and got all these extra jobs in order to go buy it. If she had just, you know, okay, I have a phone, I don't need anything else now.
Right. I think you're making my point. My point was that demand is composed of two pieces. One is the desire or the need. In the case of food and shelter, it's partly need and partly desire. We have to have food and shelter, but we prefer certain types. In the case of the iPhone, it's almost all desire, not need, although you could argue that you can't function in many ways in the modern society without a phone, so there is a certain amount of need. But that's on one side of the demand. That's half of demand. And the other half is the ability to pay for it. And your daughter had the ability to go out and get babysitting jobs and make the money to buy her phone. Now, good on her that she happens to be a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. She was born into a family in a wealthy enough neighborhood that she could watch other kids as a child. She could watch other kids and earn enough money to buy a $500 phone. Most people in the United States, that's not true of. But even if that was true of everybody, the fact of the matter is that demand is what drove that. That if there were not people like your daughter, or others, you know, who wanted the functionality that Steve Jobs' phone had and had the means to buy it, there would not be any, you know, the iPhone would be a marginal product right now, or it would be consigned to the dust heap of history because it would have been too expensive.
But Tom, I think you're missing the point. The point is that if she had stayed with the phone that I supplied her, which was a cheap flip phone that was as basic as you can possibly get, if she was going to be satisfied with that, then she would not have gotten out. And
no, you're making the argument that supply stimulates demand, and I'm agreeing that innovation, and I said this earlier, innovation will generate demand. It will generate part of that demand equation. But if the other half of that demand equation, the ability to pay for it, isn't there, that demand is useless and meaningless.
Right,
if Steve Jobs had priced that iPhone at $20,000 a unit, because that's what it actually cost to make them, there's no way that your daughter would have been able to save enough money to buy them. There would have been plenty of supply. He could have made all kinds of them in China, but nobody would have bought them. Demand is what drives economies. Supply meets demand. What Jobs knew was that if he was going to stimulate demand by making something available, he had to do it in a way that would balance with demand. You can't simply say, I'm going to start making pet rocks, and all of a sudden everybody's going to want them. I mean, you know, that worked once for a few months. It was a fad, but, you know, there were a lot of people who got burned in the pet rock business or the Beanie Baby business, or, I mean, you know, fill in the blanks. Yes, there are fads where supply at a certain level stimulates desire-driven demand, but very quickly those fade out. And over a long period of time, though, demand is what drives the economy. And frankly, the demand for iPhones is now being supplanted for the demand of the functionality of the iPhone, not the iPhone itself. And so you've got, you know, other people, other manufacturers coming in and saying, I'll meet that demand, and I'll do it in a way that's less expensive than Steve Jobs' product.
Right, but had Steve Jobs come out with it and nobody wanted a computer in their hand, then he would have had all this production, and his business would have failed.
As many businesses do, probably most businesses do, because the people who start them misunderstand. Here I am sounding like Sarah Palin. Don't really get, you know, or don't have a clear understanding of what the demand in the marketplace looks like, or don't have the means or the sophistication to communicate the benefits and features of their product to the people who, you know, in order to stimulate that demand, or to assert that this meets your needs. This will either create your desire or this meet your needs with sufficient strength that those people will reach into their pocket and pull out the money and say, okay, here. Because the money is, in economic terms, you and I are talking here, you know, this is kind of a semantic conversation at a certain level, because we're talking about supply and demand in the abstract. Talk to an economist. Demand is buying things in an economy, period. Demand is the sucking sound in the economy. And if you don't have that demand, no amount of supply is going to make any difference. On the other hand, if you've got a lot of that demand and supply is small, then you have a problem called inflation. And that's what happened with the Arab oil embargo in the 1970s, for example.
Right, but in Steve Jobs' case, he didn't know if there was going to be a demand because nobody ever had anything like this before. And like you said before, he could have failed if nobody had wanted it. But the other thing I want to point out is that I resent the fact that you call my daughter a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. We grew up in poverty in the Bronx, and I worked my butt off to get to where I am today. And I resent the fact that somebody would call me lucky from my daughter from the Lucky Sperm Club when, in fact,
she's lucky to have a dad who worked his butt off to get up to the point to where you could live in a neighborhood where she could go out and get those kinds of jobs and she could buy a $200 phone. The vast majority of children in the United States, or actually iPhones are $550 right now at retail. The vast majority of children in the United States, teenagers in the United States, do not have the ability to earn that kind of disposable income. You have to acknowledge that. I wasn't making that as a criticism.
I grew up piss poor in the Bronx, and what I did is I would do odd jobs. I used to sweep people's front stoops for a quarter.
I sold Grit magazine door to door when I was 8 years old. My dad was unemployed at the time. He was selling World Book Encyclopedias door to door. And Rexair vacuum cleaners. We were getting our food at the surplus food place for weeks. We would eat nothing but macaroni and these giant bricks of American cheese. My kids are members of the Lucky Sperm Club.
I would say you're wrong on that too. They are a member of a club who have a father who they were able to do from your example, and they were able to learn from your
example. And the reality is in America there are, and Robert, this is the lesson that white America doesn't know, is the story of white privilege. The reality is that there are a lot of African Americans out there who worked just as hard as you and I did and didn't make it. That the average wealth of an American white family right now is around $81,000, and the average wealth of an American black family right now is around $5,000, and the average wealth of a single black mother, a mother with the children or child who is not married, is under $2,000. Whereas for a white woman who is unmarried with children, it's around $30,000. And what those things reflect is white privilege. What they reflect is the fact that white people are standing on top of thousands of years of functional culture, passing down strategies and techniques and literacy, you know, from generation to generation. And African Americans have a giant hole that was pulled out of that.
All right. First of all, I disagree with that, too, because, number one, I have many friends from Africa, and they don't consider themselves African-Americans. They consider themselves Kenyans.
Their culture wasn't devastated. They actually remember their original language. I know Kenyans who can speak Bantu. You're not going to find an African-American whose relatives were brought here from Kenya. Actually, very few of them were, because they were mostly from East Africa, but in Kenya's West Africa. West Africa came here, and most of Kenya's in East Africa. But in any case, you're not going to find many African-Americans, you know, whose ancestors were brought here as slaves, who speak the language that their ancestors spoke when they came to this country. That's the great cultural destruction I'm talking about. When people go through that, there is a period of time, and it's dozens of generations it takes to recover from that. It happened in Europe. It happened to your ancestors and mine. Only it happened 3,000 years ago when the Celts came through and destroyed the tribal people of Europe. And then it happened again 2,000 years ago when the Roman Empire came through. The Celts allowed them to at least keep their religion. The Roman Empire came through and changed their language. And then the Catholic Empire came along 1,000 years ago and took their religion. And none of us remember the things that our ancestors had 3,000 years ago.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So we've had several thousand years to recover from that great cultural loss. African Americans have had a couple of generations, at the most. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, our Talk Radio News Report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where with the coming holidays, you can give a crystal heart pendant to somebody with a small donation over at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, and those pendants are made by women who have seen somebody who die. Basically.
Right.
Is that right, Ellen?
Exactly. And, of course, we still have goats, and it's a great Easter Passover present, goats,
yeah.
You know, right, of course.
And this is your little charity that you started over
there
in
South
Sudan.
That's right, and I just got back from South Sudan yesterday. So,
whoa.
We did a really, if I can just take a second,
please,
did a really interesting experiment. We brought physicians with us this time, and we did a medical exam and blood work on every returnee. And although
are the slaves that are coming back to South Sudan from North Sudan.
The former returning slaves versus the villages, and we took blood from both groups to see if there was a difference. Preliminarily, there is a difference in terms of protein needs, huge difference, but we have to crunch the numbers, and they're going to publish data. So that's fascinating. We've never been able... People say, oh, these people aren't really slaves. Well, how come there is such a huge difference between this group of people and villagers?
Right. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, very different.
Well, when you get the details, come on. We'll just take a segment. You can come on and talk about it.
Well, we'll do that when we crunch the numbers. They'll probably take a few months, but we are going to crunch those numbers. Okay, so the president is in Israel, and he made a speech to Israeli students today. He was very sort of forthcoming on the speech. He said that I think one of the most interesting things he said is peace must be made amongst people, not just governments. He's absolutely right about that, particularly in that situation. And that he said that President Mahmoud Abbas, he said, is a true partner for the Jewish people. He credited Abbas with having convinced many Palestinians to stay away from violence. Of course, he did not deal with Hamas. And there was this rocket that was lobbed from Gaza to Israel, and the United Nations did finally condemn that today. During the noon briefing, they were asked about it and later issued a statement. So we sort of have that piece going on.
Is the president meeting with Abbas?
He met with Abbas today in Ramallah, but he did not meet with the Hamas people.
Right.
Hamas, yes. They get
Abbas
confused.
Is the Palestinian Authority. And Hamas, which runs the West Bank. And Hamas is the group that has historically been sponsored by Iran and a big presence in...
And runs Gaza.
And runs Gaza. Big presence in what's the country that's split up with a green line and all that? Whatever.
There was also the president had, when he made his speech today at the convention center, he was interrupted by a heckler who was trying to get Jonathan Pollard, who is in a life imprisonment situation for spying for Israel here in the United States, freed. President Obama handled the heckler pretty well. And tonight there was a state dinner at the president's house, which is Shimon Peres. And I actually have interviewed Peres twice.
Wow.
And it's very interesting because when I interviewed him, he said to me, you have to deal with your enemy. You must deal with your enemy. You cannot just pretend they don't exist or continue to treat them as an enemy. And you can see why he really won the Peace Prize for that, because he's not one of these guys that's stupid.
Right. Well, at that time, Shimon Peres was the prime minister, not the president. So he had power as the president.
That's right.
He's ceremonial.
President's a ceremonial job. But that's where the state dinner is happening because technically he's the president of the state. That's right. Tomorrow, the president is going to be going to Yad Vashem to the Theodore.
Oh, that's a shattering experience.
A shattering experience. So that is the memorial to the Holocaust Jews. And by the way, one of the things I'm interested in doing is doing a mini Holocaust, both exhibit and museum in South Sudan. This is the largest genocide since World War II.
Wow, the genocide of the Sudanese.
Of the,
and
the South Sudanese and Darfurians, yeah. 4.5 million people.
Wow.
Yeah. Since because it was spread over so many years, it doesn't get, it's more than Cambodia and Rwanda combined.
Wow.
He's also going to be going to the Theodore Herzl grave and then going to Bethlehem to the Church of the Nativity with Prime Minister Abbas. And then he's going to be taking off for Jordan. So that's sort of tomorrow. Meanwhile, Karen Bass tomorrow, she's the congresswoman from California, 37th District. She is actually going to put forth a bill on student loans. And what she's basically saying on that is that she wants to create a 10-10 plan where 10% of somebody's net income would go to pay the discretionary income, in other words, would go to pay for student loans for 10 years and then afterwards would be forgiven. She wants to cap the interest rate at 3.4%. They keep changing it every year in Congress, having to reauthorize it.
Right.
She wants to suspend interest rates while borrowers are unemployed. She wants to reward graduates for entering public service.
This is a gradual, small-step variation on my call for an absolute jubilee for student loans. We've got $1 trillion in student loan debt.
$1 trillion. That's right.
Yeah.
It's only loans that are held larger than that are mortgages, home mortgages.
Right. And none of it should have existed. We should be like the other developed countries in the world. We should be giving people college educations for free.
100%. Now, if you want to go to a Cadillac school, well, maybe. Maybe not, but,
yeah, if you
but
go
there's
to Harvard,
no reason.
That's fine.
You
can pay for it. But if you want to go to Michigan State University, it should be free.
I agree
that's
with
why,
you.
That's why Lincoln made it a land-grant college.
I agree with you 100%, and it's just crazy. We're not investing in our future because what
that's
you
right.
invest there comes back to us.
That's right.
Okay. Interesting on a few other things. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. He's also from California. He said that $250 billion, he said today, has been taken out of the economy, a U.S. economy, from cyber hacking. Now, usually we get this, you know, I'm stuck in the Philippines or I'm stuck in London. Mm. Please wire me money. And, you know, you just
right,
saw the person
viruses,
10 minutes
yeah.
ago. Well, I actually got an interesting take on that. Today, my brother Michael sent me somebody from South Sudan, and I need to get a visa to go to South Sudan, and somehow I can't get this visa, and I've been granted this land, and I'm willing to give you 20% of
this.
This
is a variation on the old Nigerian scheme.
It's Nigeria has now moved to the South Sudan scheme.
Oh, geez. Or they have a mailing list. They bought a mailing list of people who are donors to charities that are affiliated with South Sudan.
And
the scammers are
Michael
getting more
got
sophisticated.
That. I haven't gotten it yet.
That's amazing. The scammers are getting more sophisticated. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is where you just, you know, wish people would say, okay, damn it, we're going to do it. For example, here in the United States, Harry Reid and Dick Durbin, the two guys who basically run the Senate. Harry Reid says, this is after, again, Kelly Ayotte, a Republican from New Hampshire, has filibustered a budget bill. Jerry Moran, senator from Kansas, a Republican from Kansas, blocked it even from being discussed. The two of them basically are filibustering this budget bill. And so Harry Reid comes out and says, it's things like this that will cause the Senate to have to reassess all the rules because right now they accomplish so little. I'm disappointed. And Dick Durbin says, you know, back when he supported Harry Reid in not blowing up the filibuster, he says, I supported Harry's decision to try to work out a bipartisan agreement on the rules because I think it's in the best interest of the institution, that'd be the Senate. But I can tell you the abuse that we've seen, that would be by the Republicans, since then is not encouraging at all. I think we need to get back to regular order, and that means stopping the abuse of the filibuster. There's a very good op-ed on this over at Daily Kos, and they're quoting Greg Sargent, saying basically, empty threats make Dems look weak and do nothing to discourage Republican obstructionists. In other words, if you're going to do it, do it, as Joan MacArthur says. And, Joan, I totally agree with you. This is you know, Harry Reid complaining. Don't complain. Do something about it. Same thing is happening in Europe. The Eurozone financial crisis, it's plagueing Cyprus. And the Cypriot citizens are receiving a crash course in how an out-of-control banking industry and their corrupt banksters can bring an entire country to its knees. And the Cypriot economy is ground to a halt. Why? Because their banking sector's falling apart. Why? Because their banks had actually made big bets on Greek bonds. They didn't work out so well. And Cyprus has been hit by a recession just like everybody else in Europe. So the banks in Cyprus have been shut all week. They're not supposed to open until Tuesday to try and prevent a run on the banks. Good luck with that. When all said and done, and if the Cypriot economy ever recovers from this financial collapse, the Cypriots are going to, you know, hopefully have a newfound awareness of their banks and the importance of banking and the horrors of, you know, banksters run amok. It's like, you know, what is the summer or the spring break? Girls Gone Wild. This is banksters gone wild, right? And, you know, we need oversight and regulation over the financial industry. Cyprus needs it big time. And by the way, that's what Iceland did. And it's working. In 2008, when the global financial crisis began taking down economies one by one of the countries that was hit incredibly hard was Iceland. There were three big banks in Iceland. All three of them went down. They all collapsed. Their stock exchange, it's called the OMX Iceland 15, crashed. It plummeted. Pension funds were slashed. Businesses were wiped out. The whole country just instantly impoverished. Essentially instantly impoverished. Now, the people of Iceland, the country of Iceland, could have responded to the financial crisis the same way we did here in the United States. Hey, bail out the banksters. Don't punish them. Don't send Jamie Dimon to jail. Give him money. Or Iceland could arrest the banksters that brought down the economy. They could bail out those who were most afflicted by the collapse, the average Icelanders themselves, and begin to rebuild their financial industry, the banking industry, from scratch. We chose the former. Iceland chose the latter. They said, jail the bums. In December of 2008, the Icelandic parliament passed a bill establishing an office of the special prosecutor. The job of that new office was to investigate suspected criminal conduct leading up to or in connection with or in the wake of the banking crisis, and to follow up those investigations specifically, intentionally, by bringing criminal charges, not civil charges. We're not saying, oh, your bank's going to pay a $212 million fine for the $1 billion you stole. No, actually bringing criminal charges against those responsible for the crisis and throwing their butts in prison. Since the Office of the Special Prosecutor was created, Iceland has been rounding up one bankster after another. In March of 2011, Robert and Vincent Chenguiz were arrested in London as part of the Special Prosecutor's Office investigation into the collapse of the Icelandic bank Kaupthing. In December of last year, Reykjavik court sentenced two of the top executives at Iceland's bank Glitnir to jail time. And just yesterday, nine more banksters from the Icelandic bank Kaupthing were indicted and charged for their roles in orchestrating five large-scale market manipulation conspiracies. These are only a few of the arrests. Iceland is cleaning up their banks. And what they're doing is they're putting the banksters in jail. Meanwhile, here in the United States, the Wall Street banksters who brought our economy to its knees are still sitting pretty in their corner offices or retired with hundreds of millions of dollars of your money. I mean, look at Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan. In a recent report on J.P. Morgan's monumental multi-billion dollar trading loss, Dimon is alleged to have criminally withheld from regulators key details about the bank's daily losses. And numerous other reports have suggested that Diamond may have been complicit in J.P. Morgan Chase engaging in additional criminal and or unethical activity. But Diamond and the rest of his fat cat buddies, doing just fine. They got their chauffeured limousines and their helicopters and their mansions and their mistresses and God only knows what. Continuing to rake in multi-million dollar bonuses or golden parachute retirement. I don't know if Jamie Dimon has a mistress or not. I shouldn't throw that in. Diamond's actions pale in comparison to executives at the HSBC Bank, who recently admitted in court to allowing Mexican and Colombian drug cartels to launder $900 million through their bank. Now, if you had laundered $900 million of Mexican drug cartel money, you would be in jail for the rest of your life. You have any doubt about that? I mean, they would kick in your door. But we're talking here about rich white banksters who give politicians millions of dollars. Executives of the banks also admitted using various schemes to move around hundreds of millions of dollars to nations who are supposed to be subject to trade sanctions, including Iran, Cuba, and Sudan. And reports suggest some of that money made its way into the hands of terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda. If you'd done that, you'd be in Guantanamo. But then again, you are not a bankster, in all probability. There may be some banksters listening. If you are, you know what I'm saying. Despite these egregious criminal actions, the United States has yet to jail a single HSBC bankster. Not one. Nor has England, to the best of my knowledge. So what's the bottom line to all this? Eventually, when Cyprus's economy recovers, that government is going to have to make a choice. They can choose to let their banksters go free and risk another financial meltdown like we did in the United States. Or they can take the Icelandic approach, crack down on corruption in the financial industry, prosecute and jail those responsible for causing and worsening the collapse. By the way, which is what Ronald Reagan did with bankster S&L banksters here in the United States in 1986. At the start of the 2008 worldwide economic collapse, Iceland was in worse shape financially than every other country in the world, the developed countries. Today, they're home to one of the fastest growing economies in the world. They got from there to here by throwing their banksters in jail. Hopefully Cyprus is going to, you know, take a page out of that book. And, by the way, wouldn't be such a bad idea here in the United States as well. They shouldn't be too big to fail. And to paraphrase Elizabeth Warren, they shouldn't be too big to jail. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So when is America going to wake up? We got Elizabeth Warren talking about this, too big to jail. Maybe Bernanke will come around. Let's see. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. And by the way, the legislature, the House of Representatives of the great state of New Hampshire, said just that yesterday. No, Walmart is not a person. They endorsed a constitutional amendment that would say corporations are not people and money is not speech. How cool is that? Mike in Fairfax, Virginia, says you disagree with me that the left is blaming the banks but not the politicians. Do I have that right?
Well, what I think is it's an oversimplification to lay 100% of the guilt at the banks. There's three actors in this saga. There's the banks that enabled the politicians through excessive lending, politicians who borrowed more than they could ever pay, and the people who elected the politicians, and they were awfully happy when they got 2 years of unemployment, 30-hour work weeks, free health care, free this, free that. And now the banks are saying, hey, that wasn't a gift. You got to pay that back, and the whole thing's coming apart. Yeah. And in addition to that, over the last decade, those banks have refinanced that debt probably at least five times that I'm aware of. So they've made an act of good faith to work with the governments. And the governments have demonstrated that they can't manage their budgets to ever repay the debt.
No, not true. Not true. The bank, the governments, first of all, I don't disagree with the notion that the politicians, particularly in Greece, bear a large chunk of the blame, because the politicians in Greece conspired with Goldman Sachs. And Matt Taibbi laid this out brilliantly in a piece for Rolling Stone that's still on their website. You can easily Google the thing down. The politicians of Greece conspired with Goldman Sachs to hide their debt, so they got below that debt is no greater than 3% of GDP level, so that they qualified for entry into the European Union. And Goldman Sachs took a bunch of that debt and turned it into an asset magically, right? And those politicians should be in jail, just like the people at Goldman Sachs should be in jail, or, you know, if the Greeks were going to go that route, or there should be some penalty to them. I agree with you on that.
I just think it's not 100% guilt at the bank's feet. I would put 25% at the banks for enabling the governments to overspend, 50% on the politicians.
But see, I would tell you the governments are not overspending, Mike. That's the fundamental fallacy of what you're saying.
Governments don't spend money.
No. Here's the thing. When times are good in the business, this is the nature of capitalism. And this is not a Marxist perspective. This is just Econ 101. The nature of capitalism is that there is a business cycle. There is a natural business cycle. There have been all these different efforts to quantify it and identify it, the Kondracki wave and, you know, all these different wave theories. And,
yep.
and nobody's really nailed it down, and there's all these different competing theories. And there are, of course, things that vary the business cycle, like price shocks, you know, bad weather creating shortages of necessary commodities like food or oil shortages, strategic commodities, whatever. All these things influence the business cycle. But the reality is that in a capitalist economy, you're going to have some really good years and you're going to have some really bad years. And so and the bad years are particularly dangerous for democratic governments, for any kind of government, in a capitalist economy, because in a bad year, if a certain threshold of people get laid off and go from being producers of goods and services and producers of tax money that, you know, goes to help fund the commons and the government, to consumers of goods and services and consumers of tax money, then the government and the government does not step in and say, we will help you through this tough time. In other words, here's an unemployment check for you, and we will provide you with your health insurance. If the government fails to do that, then what happens is that recession gets twice as deep, because those people don't have any money in their pocket to spend, and it is spending which is the principal driver of demand, which is what drives economies. And this is why, from the founding of this republic, just to use America as an example, from 1787 until 1935, we never went more than 15 years without a major national stock market crash and bank panic. Never more than 15 years. That was considered the business cycle. It was a 15-year cycle.
Yep.
It was, you know,
I agree with you.
Okay. So what FDR did was he said, we're going to even out the business cycle. We're going to have, when times are good, we're going to collect a lot of taxes. We're going to have a top tax rate of 91%. And, you know, people are only going to pay it if they're making piles of money, right? So when times are good, we're going to fill the government coffers up. And when times are bad, when the business cycle collapses, we're going to spend that money back out into the economy through unemployment insurance and Social Security pensions and food stamps and all these kind of things. And that's going to even out the business cycle. And for the first time in the history of our nation, we went from 1935 until 2008 without a single banking panic. And it was because of that stabilizer. Now, shift that to Europe. Greece has a stabilizer built into their system, just like we do, unemployment insurance. But Greece signed this stupid agreement with the European Union that says that if their national debt goes over 3%, they've got to start selling off their streets. They've got to stop having those stabilizers. They've got to say no to their unemployed people. If you're unemployed more than a year, you don't have health insurance anymore. This is nothing to do with generous benefits. This is stabilizers. This is stuff to protect not just people, but to protect capitalism. If their debt goes over 3%, they can't borrow anymore. They can't do it. They've got to cut to the bone. And what that does is it causes capitalism to do what capitalism does, which is when it goes into a downward spiral, if there's nothing to catch that spiral, to stop that spiral, it keeps going deeper. And that's why you've got 33% unemployment in Greece right now. It's why you got 26% unemployment in Spain right now. It's why Italy is looking at 19% unemployment, because the stabilizing systems have been stopped by this idiotic agreement with the European Union that if you're going to use the euro, your debt-to-GDP ratio can't exceed 3% in any one year, no matter how bad the recession of that year is. And that's going to kill the euro and the European economy. And it's got nothing to do with being too generous or socialism or any of that nonsense.
Well, real quick, if you think that Goldman should be in jail for what they did to call Greek debt an asset,
yeah,
Ben Bernanke should be the first one standing trial, because
Right now, he holds something like $2 trillion of our own debt. That's monetizing the debt. You guys always say Social Security holds assets, but all they hold is debt. That's no different than what they did in Greece. And then the first point I would make is Operation Twist. All this Operation Twist is doing is basically refinancing the mortgage. And there's going to come a time where you're not going to be able to finance your long-term debt at 1.5%.
I agree.
Rates will go up.
I agree, Mike.
And the cost of service, the American debt, is going to shoot through the roof, and you're going to have to cut programs.
I don't disagree with you at all, Mike. You're going to have to cut programs, or you're going to have to raise taxes. If you go back and you look at how America worked before the Reagan tax cuts, when he took it down from 74% down, things worked just fine, thank you very, very much. In fact, we were prosperous.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, before Reagan cut taxes on the rich and on corporations and started all these corporate loopholes, we had four consecutive decades of more than 3.2% GDP growth, the first time in history. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very cavillinaciously ugly, the good. Gay penguin parents. The far right loves to tell us that homosexuality is a deviation from the natural order of the world. But as we speak, two Danish penguins are proving them wrong. You heard me right. According to zoo officials, one pair of male emperor penguins has tried for years to raise a little penguin of their own. At one point, even practicing their parenting skills on a dead herring. When a particularly troublesome female penguin abandoned one of her eggs, zoo biologists decided it was time to let their famous same-sex penguin couple try out their chick-raising skills. Their first child hatched late last year, and it's been smooth sailing so far. Somewhere, Rick Santorum's head is exploding, and we couldn't be happier. The bad. Utah public schools. Earth Day is the perfect day to learn about all the wonderful things fossil fuels have done for us, right? Well, apparently Utah public school officials think so. They've teamed up with the state's oil and gas industry to sponsor a contest encouraging students to design posters celebrating the economic impact of the fossil fuel industry. Great timing, guys. Earlier this month, Science magazine published a study warning that global temperatures are at their highest in 4,000 years. Global warming is a colossal threat to global security, but the fossil fuel industry cares only about one thing, profits. And if that means polluting our school system with science-denying propaganda, then so be it. Utah's public school system should be ashamed. And the very, very ugly, the Lincoln Journal and its readers. West Virginia is no stranger to racial controversy, but an editorial published this week in Lincoln County's local newspaper displays a level of bigotry that's incomprehensible by almost any standard of behavior. The anonymous column, titled White is Right, uses explicit racial epithets and calls for the execution of blacks, gays, Italians, and Catholics. To make matters worse, some residents have expressed support for the column's hateful views.
I have to read it now. I'll agree with that.
For sure.
You do agree with us?
Yeah.
Get rid of them.
What I think.
What do you think?
Look, the Lincoln Journal has the right to print whatever it wants, but there really is no editorial justification for publishing columns calling for killing people. Doing so just reinforces and normalizes the worst sort of hate speech. If the paper was so concerned about shedding light on racism, why didn't they publish an editorial notifying readers about the offensive piece? The whole situation is just very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Oh, and then, you know, speaking of inconsistent and insane, Congressman Steve Stockman, the Republican from Texas, a Republican from Texas, is tweeting. He opposed the Violence Against Women Act because it protected transgendered women. Now he's saying, this is one tweet, the best thing about the earth is if you poke holes in it, oil and gas come out. And then he adds to that, there's reportedly $1 trillion in oil off the coast of California, but liberal hatred of science and human progress keeps them bankrupt. Well, Stevie, California's not bankrupt anymore, first of all. Jerry Brown got a resolution passed by the voters to raise taxes on rich people, and it's doing pretty good, number one. Number two, as you pump ancient sunlight, ancient carbon, out of the ground and put it into the atmosphere, you're messing up things for future generations. I mean, this is the kind, I get it. He's a Republican from Texas. Of course, he's got some oil billionaire line in his pockets, whining and dining him, taking him out to fancy places to eat, you know, making sure he gets reelected. It's a sad reality in America. It's a reality that this constitutional monarchy that we call the United States, that's supposed to be a democratic republic, but, you know, because we've got 9 justices in the Supreme Court who view themselves as kings and queens, we now have a constitutional monarchy. Let's just own up to it. The doctrine of judicial review has turned the Supreme Court into the kings and queens of the country. And the monarchs decided, even though Congress said, no, we don't like it that way. The people said, no, we don't like it that way. The president said, no, we don't like it that way. The kings and queens in the Supreme Court said, money is the same thing as speech. It's not just property, it's speech. And corporations are the same thing as people, at least for the purposes of constitutional rights. And so the oil billionaires have every right to buy Steve Stockman, and he has every right to make an ass of himself in public. But it's kind of sad. It's just kind of sad. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael. Thanks for watching.
It's good to hear you. This is reminiscent of I.F. Stone years ago. But let me make my point. One could argue forever about the morality of whether people should be given big salaries and how much they contribute and blah, blah, blah. There's a very good reason to cap their income at, do like Eisenhower did, at 91%, or I believe Carter at 70%,
yeah,
74%. And not the 28% that Reagan bought us. And the reason is they're crappy investors. What do they do as investors? They give the money to the bankers, and the bankers are looking for short-term profits to gamble. Whereas if the money goes to, if it's 91%, they have two possibilities. One, they give it to their corporations, which although are good investors, they're not as good as the federal government, or they pay taxes to the government for their salary. And the net effect is that the government invests in education, in infrastructure, in research. And basically, the decades that you talk about prior to the cut of the tax rate in the United States was the decades where the United States by far led the world in technological and scientific innovation, which benefited us all.
Yep.
And now, with the curtailing of income to the government, the net effect is that they invest less. And since both the corporations and individual rich owners who have nothing to do but to invest their money and give it to banksters and do it poorly, the net effect is this country is becoming backward.
Right. And Larry Beinhart did the math on this. Yeah. And Larry Beinhart, the screenwriter, did the math on this. We had him on the show a couple of years ago. He wrote a couple of op-eds about it. Every time in American history, the top tax rate has been below 50%. During that time, we have seen the United States go through cycles of boom and bust. Because you're exactly right. Very, very rich people with a lot of hot money in their hands are lousy investors. And on the other hand, every time the top tax rate has been above 50%, we go through periods of great economic stability. Because if somebody's willing to take, you know, to pay 91% income tax and that remaining 9% that they've got, they're going to very carefully invest that money. And
yeah, the thing is that the people at that level have so much money they don't need it anyway. So they in effect always invest it because they're putting it in a bank account. But the bankers, and this is natural for corporations in a way. No, you know, the problem is they're supposed to maximize profits. But what does that mean? It's ambiguous. If this is over a 1,000-year period, well, then it may very well be terrific. But this is over a 2-day period like, what's done in the marketplace and what's rewarded, and is actually in a way very natural because, look, you and I are about 60 years old. Yeah, we're not going to see a profit that occurs 50 years hence. But for the purpose of the society, it's much more beneficial to build things that are going to last. And maybe we have this point of view, but certainly it's natural to suppose that shareholders want their reward now, not 100 years from now.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Michael, in fact, Shano tells me that you are the person today who has who's going to get a copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, in which I talk about Larry Beinhart and his research and why we should raise the top tax rate or roll back the Reagan tax cuts. So let me put you on hold. Michael is on line 8, Danielle, and she's going to get your address information, and we will send you an autographed copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, brought to you by Stamps.com or shipped to you by Stamps.com. So I hope you find that of value, Michael, and thank you for the call. John, listening on WWRL in Cortland Manor, New York. Hey, John.
Hey, John, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. You want to talk about the RICO Act?
Well, the RICO Act was put into effect originally, if I understand it right, was for organized crime. And through the years, it's been used to handcuff the unions because they aren't able to do their labor. They're able to do picket lines and things like that because of the RICO Act.
RICO was put into place to go against the mafia, and there were some times back in the 50s and 60s when some unions were corrupted by or infiltrated by the mafia, and RICO was used against them. But generally, RICO does not prevent work actions.
No, but it's
the Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, if I recall correctly.
Knowing that a crime is being committed is part of the RICO Act, correct?
You have to know that you're corrupting an organization and that you're engaging in what's referred to as racketeering. And this is the problem of using RICO against the banksters or using RICO against government, for that matter, against the Bushies for the war in Iraq, is that it is so narrowly defined that it basically can only be used against the mafia, which is unfortunate. We need something that's more general. But we should, it would be great if we had an equivalent of RICO that we could use to break up the banks. John, thanks for listening to WWRL. Thanks for calling. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
John Kenneth Galbraith, the modern conservative, is engaged in man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for superior moral justification for selfishness. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Charles in Indian Trail, North Carolina. You wanted to comment on the Greek problem in Europe. Charles? No Charles? Okay. Crickets. We lost Charles. I've been wanting to go off on this for a little bit. I'm just gonna do this in any case. I found this amazing thing. You've got this state legislator, or congressman rather, who was talking about immigrants, illegal immigrants, doing this whole riff back in his district. Oh, these illegal immigrants. And a Native American stood up and said, "We think you're all illegal immigrants." It's like, at what point in the United States are we gonna start looking at each other and saying, it's not white or black or brown or Native American or Asian. It's like, we are all human beings and we share a common set of problems. Now, that's a statement that has, this is a sword that cuts both ways, that statement. It cuts two ways. On the one hand, what it does is it minimizes the differences in experience. The difference, for example, as I said earlier, that white Americans are standing on hundreds of years of a culture of education and wealth and even middle class, even poor white Americans, frankly, and have more resources available to them and have, doors are more easily opened. And that's all still very real in our society. And African Americans are standing on a cultural holocaust, literally a holocaust. an absolute devastation, destruction, the horrors of slavery greater than most white Americans can ever imagine. I was amazed by the number of white people who went to see the movie Django and came out just totally rattled. It's like, you know, what did you not learn in school? Oh, you know, never learned about that. Slave patrols, really? So, on the one hand, the why can't we all just get along, the kind of Rodney King statement, or especially when white people say it, you know, oh, yeah. On one hand, that's the velvet glove over the iron fist of a dominator culture that says, we'd be pleased to have you be part of our culture. Just be like us. Just accept our norms. Just give up your language, give up your culture, give up your religion. This is what we said to the Native Americans. Give up your values, give up your, you know, and just, you know, buy into this whole kind of capitalist whatever, you know, Republican thing. On the other hand, and this is one of the lessons that I've learned over the years living on the water, which I arguably is a fairly elitist thing, although interestingly, here in Washington, D.C., it's one of the cheapest ways to live. Our rent's $500 a month. That's what we pay, which is pretty damn cheap in this town. But one of the things that I've learned living on the water is that you get to know your neighbors. And the reason why you get to know your neighbors is because if the weather's bad, your home could go. I mean, you could lose everything. You could die. In fact, somebody in our marina this last winter, the marina over from us, did literally die. She came home one night. She was a little tipsy, climbed up the stairs to get into her boat. There's a gap of about 2 feet between the boat and the stairs and straight down into the water. She fell right down into the water. And, you know, instant hypothermia, you mix that with a little bit of alcohol, and they found her dead body in the morning. She was drowned. So you get this sense of, you know, we're all living right on the edge of death. And so you get to know your neighbors, and you know, you get every Sunday morning there's this thing called Captain's Coffee where, you know, it's on, they rotate different people's boats every Sunday morning where, you know, people just get together, have coffee and donuts. Hey, what's going on? What do you know? Hey, there's a new fire extinguisher. I'm serious. I'm not making this up. You know, it's now Halon is no longer, you can't use it anymore because it's a climate changing gas. So everybody has to change their fire extinguishers. So, you know, it's like stuff like that. But the point is that what we haven't realized as Americans yet, black, white, brown, Native American, Asian, you pick your minority group, multiracial, biracial, gay, straight, what we haven't realized is that we are all also close to death. That, and I mean that both metaphorically and literally, because global warming is so real and it has such destructive potential. I mean, it's particularly scary for those of us who live on the water, but it is so real. And the economic devastation that has been wrought by the top 1/100th of 1%, you know, corrupting our political systems, corrupting our economic systems, all this stuff. They're literally destroying people's lives. 40,000 people a year in the United States die because they lack health insurance. We really are living on the edge, and death really is a piece of it. And I think when we start as Americans realizing that we're a little closer to that edge than we thought, that we will begin to come together as community and we'll begin to start breaking down some of those barriers in a way that doesn't involve that velvet glove over the iron dominator, iron fist of the dominator culture, but instead is genuine community. That's one of the comments that Louise, my wife's grandmother, who died in her 90s a decade or more ago, said to me that really stuck with me. And this was 20, 30 years ago. She said, back in the 1930s during the Great Depression, we all got to know our neighbors because we depended upon each other. Just something to think about. I think we all, you know, we all need to realize that things are pretty rough, and we need to get to know each other, regardless of all these other artificial barriers and labels. Coming up tomorrow, get your questions ready. It's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be here taking your calls. Plus, anything goes Friday. You pick a topic. I'll riff on it. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it.
See you tomorrow. You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.